Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Answerable Questions with Questionable Answers, the show in which we try and answer some of life's meaningful and meaningless questions. My name is Marcus. That's Sarah.
It certainly is.
And over there, it's Chris.
Hello.
In the UK, we are currently having a fuel crisis. This, of course, has come in a period of pandemic. And during this pandemic, we've heard the word crisis used time and time again. Today, we're answering this question. How do you respond to a crisis?
Should we go for kind of the external crisis rather than the internal crisis?
Whatever you want, pal. You interpret it as you will.
I mean, as you would expect, I would say my faith has a huge part to play when a crisis hits, because I can...
Well, you must say, you, for those new listeners, you are an ordained vicar, Chris.
I am indeed, yes.
You were a trainee vicar when we started this podcast.
Not anymore. Yeah.
And somehow,
I didn't say anything too bad, and they let me through.
I feel that Sarah and I have somewhat played our part.
Oh, yes. 100%.
And all the listeners.
Yes. In trying to derail your career, but you didn't let us. You stood firm. You didn't have a crisis of faith or career, and you're a vicar. But anyway, without further ado, you were about to.
Yeah, I think knowing that there's something bigger than me as well, and or bigger than the crisis, is a huge comfort when something kicks off, because then you can just take a moment just to take some stock. And for me, I would, you know, breathe is a good one, isn't it? You know, just count to 10 and breathe. Realize that it probably isn't the end of the world, and that humanity has been through many crises before and survived and then thrived after. And for me, then it would be a moment to pray, to speak to other people with a similar worldview or mindset, and start to kind of gain the information that could be real that isn't pumped out through the media. Because that's the thing, is for me, even this crisis, a lot of these things, and Sarah, you know, I can't speak too much about this because this is your industry, but the media fuel these crises with the way they report often. Not all the media, just some outlets. And so for me, it's very much you see a crisis hit and I'm like, okay, take some stock. It's probably going to be okay. But equally, I can take action. I can pray, and then I can speak to people and see what would the best course of action be. So in this current fuel crisis, of which you kind of started off the show about, Marcus, it's going to be fine. Do you know what I mean? It will be fine. Just don't panic. Don't join in with what's causing the problems. Because then you're just part of the issue too.
Don't go and buy 500 packets of toilet rolls.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Blimey.
It's funny, when we were talking about doing this show, it did make me feel a little bit like, oh, I mean, I'm very proudly English and British, but I was like, we used to be known for the Blitz spirit, where a crisis had happened, people would come together. And now it feels like we are just hoarding toilet rolls and petrol and whatever seems to be a crisis. I mean, we've all seen the funny memes, especially like pubs, there's a beer crisis, you can panic buy here and things like that. But like, if that's what people think about us now, we should take some stock and not literally take stock, because that's the problem.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder if, I'm sure a lot of nationality or nations think this, I wonder if people do think about how we respond to a crisis at all, really, because they're kind of responding to their own things. But I take the point of what you're saying. People can often blame America for this. Oh, we're becoming too much like America, which I think can be quite, maybe that's unfair on Americans, but I know what you mean. I think that that's just the world in general, I think, because perhaps as we grow up, there's certainly something to be said for a society which has never had or had very, very little genuine crises, whatever the plural is, crises, because, you know, we don't know what it's like to be in a war. Wars are fought far away if they do involve Britain, which, as they have done a number of times, of course. So you don't really know. It's a fuel crisis, as you say, Chris. I understand if you're a taxi driver or you know, a delivery
driver.
An ambulance driver. It's kind of like, well, I know, actually, it's quite a big thing. But other than the a few specific examples, say, and that's not to dismiss those people, because I understand that they would be concerned. The sort of reference point of a true crisis and whatnot, I think maybe people do panic a bit more because they don't really know what it's like. We don't know. I'm putting myself in this bracket as well.
But like, is it me or, you know, during the start of the pandemic, when everyone's panic buying food as well, and you know, had to queue for the supermarkets, well, there weren't lots of countries doing that. I mean, and every country was hit by COVID-19. And there were a few doing it, but like, I'm pretty sure I read stuff about the Europeans just laughing at us.
But like, yeah, it depends.
That is sort of, I think, what Marcus, you're alluding to is that, because actually, like, you know, as a nation, we have not gone through a big national time of hardship.
No.
Like, you know, like something like the Second World War.
Yeah.
This felt like, you know, one of the times we've come close. It wasn't even close, but it won't come closest to it. So, you know, we've not had to deal with that in our lifetimes. We didn't know how to respond.
But neither did the French or the Italians or the Spanish.
Yeah, like, but I know what you mean, Chris, but I think, again, it depends which publication you read, because at the moment in our country, because of that bloody referendum, you have people who are quick to say we're doing really well and what are Europe doing, and then you have the other side of it of, oh my goodness, we're so terrible and look at the cultured Europeans laughing at us. I reckon, my guess would be, is that most other Europeans, because we are geographically, but most people who are on mainland Europe, I don't think they're that concerned about what's going on in Britain. I think I
agree with you, Marcus. I think everyone is looking at us.
Yeah.
And to be honest, we're not that important.
Well, because we're self-conscious about what we've just recently voted for. And so we think, we don't care what they think. Whereas I think the Germans, the French, whoever, you name them, are just getting on with it. And actually, I don't know what it's like. I mean, I respond?
I think my point, I mean, there's two. One was that they don't do what we've done. So regardless of how they see us.
Oh, I don't know. I think they didn't
panic buy in the same way we did.
But how do you know that? You weren't there.
Yeah.
My uncle lives in Belgium and he was saying they're basically... Maybe because he's British and they were talking to him about it.
But Belgium is certainly not the same type of country as Italy that you cited there.
No, I mean, it was an example. Italy was an example. I said European nations, Spain, Italy. I didn't want to go through all of them.
You said Southern European nations, Chris. There's a difference between...
I said France as well.
Yeah, they're in between. They bridge the gap between North and South of Europe.
But from what we know, that our response was different. It was panic buying. It was just a bit like, why are we doing that?
Yeah, I don't know, ultimately. But what I do know is...
Tell me the answer.
Well, I'll do my damnedest here. What I do know is that knowing a few people living in Italy, Italy were the ones who got the pandemic quite bad. And don't worry, ladies and gentlemen, we will talk about other things other than the pandemic, but it seems pretty relevant now, or certainly fresh in the memory. But in Italy, they got it very bad early on in Europe. And then, of course, it kind of went across Europe and reached here. And they the advice we were told is, this is one of the ways to respond to a crisis, if you can see it coming, is get yourselves on food delivery services. So sign up to, you know, whichever kind of farmhouse that do the deliveries and all that kind of stuff, and you're golden. Because in Italy, they were panic buying. The shelves were getting low, and that's what they said. And that's what, fortunately, my wife is an absolute whiz and knows all the best places and all the deals. So we've been absolutely fine. We were getting, well, better quality food, actually. I mean, it costs a few quid more, admittedly, but you get what you pay for. So that's how we sort of preempted it. So we were all right. But yeah, the pandemic is an interesting one to say, because how do people respond to it? And Sarah, we saw the best and worst of people, didn't we?
We did. And yeah, I'm not sure. I think the pandemic is quite a specific thing, because
we've
never seen the likes of that crisis. We have had fuel crises many times in this country. You know, I remember like at school at one point, people saying, we're not going to be able to get to school. It's going to be amazing. you know, like things like that. Like
the millennium bug.
Oh my goodness.
But I remember that they said that would affect the fuel pumps, because the fuel pumps wouldn't understand.
They have no idea. I mean, how to respond to a crisis is interesting. As science journalist Zaria Gorvet, who was writing for the BBC, said, the reality is that most natural human responses in the face of danger is to simply do nothing. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of fight or flight sort of stuff. And whatever the crisis is, like I said, we just talked a bit about the pandemic there, which we're all aware of. But you can have a crisis of faith. You can have a personal crisis, or I don't know, you're about to do some public speaking and suddenly you crap yourself and you think, oh, blimey, I've pictured them all closed.
That would be a crisis.
Yeah, exactly. Well, certainly of sorts. So it is interesting when to simply do nothing is that you freeze. You see that with people who sometimes if, I mean, it's more if they're scared. I understand the word crisis, we're being quite liberal perhaps with the actual sort of definition, but there's certainly you get the picture. And I think that idea that the brain freezes and your cognitive function just doesn't quite work in the way it should. I mean, there's a chap called Russell Schilling, who's the chief scientific officer for the American Psychology Association. I like to do these people a good service, you know. They
you
have
do.
These titles and these
title.
Things exactly
they
even though
hard for it.
Yeah, there is no way that they're going to listen to this. And if I pass their ideas off as my own, I wouldn't fool anybody listening to this podcast. And this person certainly wouldn't be angry because they'd never know. But old Russell said, you're trying to find a plan on how to react, but cognition becomes difficult because your limbic systems, which are the part of the brain that involve our behavioral and emotional responses, aren't working properly. You basically look like you're freezing. Your mind is desperately trying to find a plan to get through the crisis. And as a wise man once said, you know, in any time for a leader, in any time of crisis, the best thing to do is the right thing, the second best thing to do is the worst thing, and the third best thing you can do is nothing.
I can't
remember who said it.
I can't remember.
I think it was probably Lincoln or somebody like that. I think it might have been a former president.
Adolf.
Yeah. Well, on that very, very specific quote, you know, perhaps you wouldn't disagree with him, but I don't think it was anybody too nefarious.
I'm not sure I totally agree with that, though, because I do think sometimes actually, like, obviously the freeze you're talking about is where you're sort of rabbit in the headlights. Oh my God, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. My brain isn't working. Quite. But I do think sometimes there's something to be said for just pausing, taking a moment to think, to consider your options, and to not act rashly.
No, but that quote is not about acting rashly. That quote is about making a decision, whether the decision is made within the first 5 minutes or after 5 days of pondering. But you have to do something, basically. Mm.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, fine. I think... I was worrying that the freeze was getting a little bit of a hard time there, when I think there's a difference between like pausing in fear and actually taking time to consider.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
To not just jump in and perhaps get it wrong.
Sure. But it's quite interesting, though, because again, quoting old Russell Schilling, it's whether you're afraid of failing a test at school or at university, for example, or seeing a mountain lion in the wild, your limbic systems work in the same way, whether you're experiencing a fight or flight reaction. The difference is the intensity of the reaction, which I find that quite incredible, really. Yeah. That fear is, all fear comes from the sort of same place or the same sort of emotional reaction.
And that's why stress can actually make you physically ill, because your brain, say you're really stressed at work.
Yes.
Your brain thinks that every day you are going and facing a lion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's acting in the same way. And that, and you know, too much of that causes all kinds of problems in all different parts of your body, physically as well as mentally.
Mm-hmm.
We are, you know, we're not designed to be facing that kind of stress every day.
No.
So, well, yeah, that's why people do actually get physically
I think that's where for me at the start, I said my faith would make a difference, because it does bring peace. And so therefore, when you feel peaceful, then you're not feeling fearful.
Mm.
And therefore, you can then start to make the decisions that you need to make. Because as you said, Marcus, you need to make a decision in the crisis. But it's really hard to do that when you're... We talked about it in a previous show a couple of weeks ago about kind of your amygdala starts to go crazy. And connected to these lymphatic glands or whatever they are, and how, like, because of that you can't make the right decision because your brain is so fuzzy.
Yeah,
so you really need to lower the anxiety, lower the, you know, get rid of the fear, feel peaceful, then you can try and make the right decision. But I'm interested in whether you guys are, would you say you're fight, flight or freeze?
I'm a freezer.
You're a freezer.
I'm a freezer. I do need, like, I always need time to process things, and yeah, I would definitely say I'm of the freezing nature.
Yeah. What about you, Chris? Because I think you can stay quite cool and calm in moments of crisis. I think if it, you know, of all the people I know, I think I think you'd be quite a handy person to have around in a crisis, if I may say so.
Yeah, I think I pride myself on being quite good in a crisis. I think someone said to me, you're almost like, you could almost be in the emergency services. As in, like, you could turn up to something that's gone wrong and go, right, this is what we need to kind of figure out and do. Mm-hmm. I heard a theory once about people with dyslexia being exceptional in a crisis their brain has been conditioned for a long time to be in crisis in the school system we have because they're not valued as much as they should be, or it's seen as a bad thing, or even when you learn to drive and you've got to read road signs. So because of that, their brain has almost been in consistent crisis. So therefore, when a crisis turns up, they know what to do. Like their brain kind of is able to. I don't know if it's true or not. I just find it. And so since then.
Well, have you tested it? Get a dyslexic friend.
So I spoke to a few people, specifically chefs. Usually I speak to chefs and, you know, are you dyslexic
usually you speak to chefs?
No, like if I speak to a chef, I usually ask, like, are you dyslexic? And I've met quite a few that are, because it's quite a stressful environment in the kitchen.
Is that why? I'm fascinated by this, but I'm quite stumped. Are you part of the chef's union? What's going on here?
It looks like a very stressful situation.
Well, how do you talk to them, though? Because you can't say, oh, well, when I'm in a restaurant, they're tucked away in the kitchen.
They're just friends. You meet friends and they say I'm a chef, or they say I'm an ambulance worker or something like that. And I'm like, one of my questions is, if I think their job is stressful,
right,
are you dyslexic? And, you know, I've had quite a few responses, and yeah, I am actually dyslexic, but they're very good in a crisis.
Right.
It's really interesting. And I could be wrong. Someone could definitely tweet us, email in, say, you're an absolute numpty, Chris. That's wrong. But I do think it's a strength of people. Jamie Oliver talks a lot about people with dyslexia and people who have done very, very well. I think Richard Branson's a famous person. Apparently Leonardo da Vinci, people like that had dyslexia. Well, I don't know if da Vinci was in a crisis, but people who can cope with a lot are often, because I think their brain has been conditioned throughout of their life to be able to deal with that in the small ways.
But you may be thinking, layman's terms, though, that where the brain is perceived, and I stress the word perceived, to lack somewhere, it actually flourishes elsewhere.
Yeah.
But that elsewhere is often not focused on, say, in a generic education system which is trying to cater for the masses. It's very difficult when you criticize these things, you know, but you're trying to sort of get the general sort of population, but you're always going to miss out on some people who are wired a little bit differently. Yeah. But I think the way we're wired, I think, is a big one, and that is about, you know, your what you've learned in the past, what you've experienced, of course. Again, how much stress have you, you know, experienced yourself? Because as I say, I think in this country, as you said, Chris, earlier on, we sort of maybe gone into the more sort of panicky style kind of people, if you like.
We were talking earlier on before the show about friends of ours who are self-confident. And I think also if you are relatively, like, genuinely confident, not a mask and bravado and things like that, then you can turn up to a crisis. Now, I think if you think, I could figure this out because of that confidence within you, then you probably do react well in a crisis. Like, okay, there maybe for me, I don't think I react well because I think I've got it. But I do believe there's often a solution, and the job is to find that solution.
Do you think it's a case of confidence? So, for example, Chris, you were saying about faith. Is it because you are confident in your faith? You're confident in that you've got a God who loves you and who cares for you.
Yeah, and would help potentially, and not always, but that there's a way out and we can figure this out. But some people would have that confidence in themselves. Mm. I'm good enough to do something and I can figure a way out. I don't think I necessarily have that. But as you said, I definitely have faith that God will guide me when I need help.
Well, okay. What about on a more personal level, Sarah? You were a journalist for many years. You still work in the media. Mm. What if you had sort of writer's block, even though that's probably more for an author or something like that? Or what if you had a bit of a crisis with the pen or with the typewriter, or however you jot down your ideas or something like that? If you were thinking, no, I can't do my job. I'm struggling so much. You know, there was a sort of a little mini personal crisis. How would you try and punch through that?
So I have throughout the years struggled with imposter syndrome quite a lot when it comes to work. Mm-hmm. So it's something that I have not on like a kind of career ending crisis level.
Shouldn't have changed your name to J.K. Rowling then.
Yeah, exactly.
No, yeah, but yeah. I have definitely, you know, it's something that I'm aware I kind of need to stay on top of, or it could turn into a crisis. Mm-hmm. And firstly, I would say, sort of like we alluded to earlier, I remind myself that I have done it in the past. I have done a lot of good work that has been objectively recognized as good work. Mm. So I know I can do it. And following on from that, and I can't remember if I've spoken about this on the show before, but something I would recommend to anyone who has similar struggles with imposter syndrome or feeling like they're not good enough, is to have, this was told to me by a friend I used to work with, have something called a crisis folder, I call it. And into that, anytime I ever get some really good feedback, or I do a piece of work that I'm especially proud of, or people have praised me for, or any kind of really good ego boosting stuff that's happened at work, I put it in this folder. So if I'm ever having a bad day and I'm having a little bit of a crisis, I go to that folder and I can see all that stuff that I know objectively is good. And it sort of proves to me like, no, come on, you are good enough. You can do it. You have done it all these times. And here's the evidence.
And does that help?
Massively. I would really recommend it to people.
That's very interesting, that.
Very organised.
It is very organised as well. I think, yeah, because I think that sometimes when we think about a crisis, you know, we talked about pandemic, or you can use these kind of big examples. I think that often on a more personal level, that is interesting, because it feels like you can, because it's happening to you or an individual, you know, there's something you can have a bit more sort of potentially a bit more control over. But it is trying to rationalize it, essentially. You're trying to, again, it's about the brain freezing and going, I don't know what to do, I can't. And sometimes that may act, that there may be irrational acts. So some people might sort of wildly try and find a solution. And then other people say, I just can't. It's trying to kind of hang on, just kind of cool yourself and calm yourself. Because if you think about it, to use sort of sporting examples, what if, you know, a striker has a confidence issue, a crisis where he hasn't scored for a number of games or whatever. You know, how do you try and do that? There's a particular example in sport, if you can call it a sport, in darts, which I find utterly fascinating. Have you ever heard of dartitis?
No.
It's a condition which, I've just got this off the Wikipedia page, it's a condition which can affect darts players and severely damage their performance. I find this utterly fascinating. It can be compared to the yips, if you know what that is.
Oh, yeah.
But it's an expression used to describe apparent loss of fine motor skills without any explanation. The term is used in reference to players who struggle with some kind of psychological problem with their technique and even releasing their darts. So wow. They go to throw the dart, and they go to throw it, and for some reason they cannot release that dart. And this happened to Eric Bristow. Now, probably a lot of people haven't heard of Eric Bristow, maybe listen to this podcast. He was the sort of, I don't know, the sort of Lionel Messi of darts back in the day.
Michael Jordan.
The Michael Jordan of darts back in the day, exactly. And Bristow, because darts was a proper working man's sport.
Yeah.
It was a bit like snooker in a sense, but even more so a real working class hero that these guys were. And they shot to stardom and fame in the 80s. It became massive. Suddenly you got boozed up people who are having a great time singing your name and all this. And there was genuine fame and stardom and riches that came with it. It was incredible. And Bristow was the man. He would turn up. And a bit like Arnold Schwarzenegger at the old Mr. Universe events, everyone knew he was going to win. He'd just walk in and it'd be like, oh, Eric's here. Yeah, okay. You're fighting for second place, essentially. And he suffered from this. And he swept the boards. And he was talking about it. And he does come across as quite arrogant, especially when he was talking back in the day, but also very confident. And bang, this thing hit him and could not release a dart. That is an absolute crisis of confidence.
How did he get out of it?
Well, He eventually did, but he never got back to the heights that he had before. I think he maybe only won one championship after it, but prior to that, he'd absolutely swept the boards and cleaned up. But that I find really fascinating, the sporting examples. How do you get someone back? And it is trying to reassure them, trying to tell them, like you said, Sarah, you've done it before. And maybe if you haven't done it before, you know, you can do this. That is essentially it. It just real basics, Chris.
It's the importance of just surrounding yourself with good people, isn't it?
Yeah.
Actually can speak wisdom. And we talked about this throughout the whole show every week.
It's favorite theme,
but it very much is, as you said, like who can get around you when you're either in a personal crisis, who can speak truth into you. That, you know, using Sarah's example, you're good at this, Sarah. You did well at university. You know, you're da 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 da. And actually, because I think we believe a lot of like untruths about ourselves, and it's really good to have people start to speak truth into you, because you can't listen to a lie when you're hearing the truth as well.
Well, it kind of goes where you find your identity. If you find your identity as being the best darts player in the world, and suddenly that doesn't happen, your whole world crumbles.
Yeah.
I was listening to a podcast the other day, a Carrie Newhoff leadership podcast, and he was interviewing, what's the lady called who runs Netflix, Erin something or other. And she was talking about how they have this 360 feedback thing right in Netflix where everybody speaks to you about basically what you're not good at. I think they do like what's your best behavior and what's your worst behavior. But she said to start with, that could feel like a bit of anxiety inducing. And then you start to realize quite a few things. One is that actually the group usually will get to the one thing that you need to work on. So you also don't need to worry about the other 15 things that you think you need to work on, because actually they come in and go, so you are good at that. Now don't worry about that. No one cares about that. That's the one thing. So it actually reduces a lot of the stress. But equally, if let's say Marcus said, hey, Chris, I think you need to work on this. And Sarah could come in and go, I actually really disagree, Marcus. I think you're not seeing this properly. Mm-hmm. You then start to get more and more affirmed. So anyway, my point is, I think doing it collectively, bringing your crisis to a group who you trust and who value you and actually have your back and your best interests. We say that every week, your best interests at heart, really want you to succeed. That is a very good way of getting out of a crisis.
Yeah.
Personal absolutely. One anyway.
No, not the petrol, but you might need petrol. Well, how to respond in a crisis? Well, look, but the thing is, if you are somebody who really does need the petrol, how are you going to respond? Well, you've got to go and find a petrol station and queue up then. Do you know what I mean? You've got to get stuck in.
Yeah.
That's how you to respond quite quickly before the stocks go low. I know that's people might think, oh, come on, don't go into the panic and so on. Well, if you need it.
Also, sometimes I think it's a bit easy to turn it into this massive sort of thing, and I don't even know where to start because it's such a big crisis that I'm in. You know, say it is, you know, you're an emergency worker and you need petrol, whatever it may be. Sometimes you just need to find one step to take.
There's
that saying, isn't there, do the next right thing, just do something. It doesn't you don't have to have the answer to solving the entire crisis, but sometimes it is. So like I went through a time a while back where kind of everything that could go wrong went wrong. There were deaths in the family. There was illness. There was mental health problems. It felt like even my cat died. It was very sad. Mm. But it really felt like I don't know how to deal with this situation because it's so big and so terrible. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just need to find one thing to do that I need to speak to this one person, or I need to, you know, just take one step. And often you find once you've taken one step, it feels a little bit more manageable, and with every step it becomes more and more manageable. But that freeze that you get in front of a big situation, I think my advice is just take one small step.
There's the advice, there it is. And and of course, you know, if you can keep your wits about you while all others are losing theirs and blaming you, the world will be yours and everything in it. And what's more, you'll be a man, my son. And, you know, insert lady and daughter if you're a woman. Rudyard Kipling there. What a way to finish.
What a way to go out, hey? What a way to do it.
So, yeah, there we are. How to respond to a crisis? Well, just...
poetry.
Buy those, buy the toilet roll as quickly as possible, you know, et cetera, et cetera. No, maybe think a bit longer term as well. It's not all about the short term. A crisis will pass. And then what? There we are. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening to Answerable Questions with Questionable Answers. We're on Insta and Twitter at AQQAPod. Sometimes we pose these questions here, so do check us out on there. But until next week, thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. See you next week.